So welcome to Two Crees in a Pod. We are doing season 5 and we are in episode 4. And today we have Dr. Keisha Supernant, who is joining us. And hello, Keisha.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. So we wanted to just start by asking you just to introduce yourself and the work that you are doing with the University of Alberta.
Be happy to. So, Keisha Supernant Ninsikatsan, Namiskutiwiskaiga no Chinia, Otipinisiwaknia. So, I'm Keisha Supernant, as introduced. I am Métis, so I'm a citizen of the Métis Nation of Alberta, and I have a lot of family connections to many Métis, Cree, and Mohawk communities in Alberta, as well as some lines that lead back to Red River in one of the areas of the homeland of the Métis Nation. And I am director of the Institute of Prairie and Indigenous Archaeology, or IPIA, at the University of Alberta. So I'm an archaeologist by training. And I have been doing a lot of work with First Nations and Métis communities in Western Canada for 20 years around archaeology and related types of work.
Nice. Amazing. So what brought you to this work? What was, you know, what made you decide to get into this line of work?
So originally I was very interested in archaeology as a teenager. And when I was sort of exploring what I wanted to do when I grew up, I became quite enamored of the idea of traveling around the world and exploring ancient places and learning about the unknown and all those sort of typical things that hook young archaeologists. And so I actually studied archaeology, went into university with that intention and wanting to kind of go on and do that as a career, although I really had no idea what it really was or what it meant to kind of go to graduate school and things. I was the first generation of my family to finish university. But it turned out that it worked really well for me. But I had originally planned to go and study ancient civilizations and like travel to Egypt and, you know, all those sort of classical places that we hear so much about. But when I was in my university training, my first archaeological field experience was with a First Nation. And we worked very closely with that nation. And this was in 2001. And so before it was more commonplace in archaeology to work alongside nations, we followed protocol, we did ceremony, and there were two amazing members of that team who took me under their wing. So Betty, Charlie, and Clifford Hall, who are Scowlets, so it's one of the Stalo nations. And they just really showed me what it meant to them to be part of archaeology. And that really set me on a path to doing more collaborative work with communities. And I was also I grew up disconnected. My dad was raised in the foster care system. And so I knew we were Métis, but I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't know who we were related to. So my journey was also one of sort of starting to figure out who I was and who I belonged to. And so when I started doing collaborative work with Indigenous communities, it was also a way for me to start to, you know, build connections and learn a little bit more about, you know, sort of that sense of a reciprocal responsibility and care that comes from being a good relation. So that was part of my journey as well. And so I did my dissertation work for my PhD with working with community in British Columbia, and then came to the University of Alberta now almost 13 years ago, so in 2010. And that was really like coming home, because I started to work with my community, so with the Métis Nation, and I started to reconnect with my living relatives and kind of was really welcomed back into community in that way. And what started happening is when I was working in community, people kept asking about unmarked graves. So this is not, I didn't go into archaeology. I actually specifically avoided doing any work with ancestors. It wasn't something that interested me. I found it very spiritually difficult. Any time that there was any of that, I was not drawn to it. But communities started asking me about helping find potential unmarked graves in other places. And my area of sort of expertise within archaeology was mapping and spatial data and using technology to search the land. So I already had knowledge in that area. And so enough communities kept asking if I could help find graves. And I was like, okay, let's see if we can figure out how to do this. So I worked to build my skill set to expand it to looking below the ground and not just on the surface of the ground. And in 2018 was the first time that I actually did work on finding unmarked graves. And that was at a residential school in Saskatchewan, when an amazing graduate student came to join me who had experience. And the two of us went out with our colleagues from the University of Saskatchewan and did work at Muskaugen. And that was 2018, so 5 years ago now. And ever since then, it's been something that communities have come and asked me to help them, to help find these places of our relatives. And this is both at Indian residential schools, but also at places like historic cemeteries or other burial grounds where communities know that people are buried there, but they don't know exactly where, and they don't know how many, and they don't kind of know where, what the extent of that area is. So we just try to help figure that out as best we can.
I have a question. So, just for our listeners, how many Indian residential schools have you been working with or have done searches at so far?
So far, I have been involved directly in doing searches at 8 schools, seven in Alberta and one in Saskatchewan. And this is since 2018, but there has been obviously a really big expansion of this work in the almost 2 years now since Tecumseh Tushwekmek made their announcement around the 215. And at that point, like I said, I already had been doing this work. And as an Indigenous person, I was one of the few Indigenous people who was doing the work on the ground with the technology and had the experience. And so I started getting emails and phone calls almost right away. I ended up also getting a lot of calls from the media, so trying to communicate as best I could around what I knew about the technology and that kind of thing. So 8 schools, but me and my team have spoken with and provided advice to over 40 First Nations and some Métis nations as well around this issue.
And you're a team of how many?
Well, there's me and one full-time staff member. And then we work with a lot of, we have summer students and we have graduate students, but we're pretty small and I've been trying to expand what we are, but I'm not a business, right? I'm not here to this is not something that I make money off of. This is something that I'm really committed to, but it means that I can't sort of just turn around and hire people as a researcher at the university. I have to apply for grants, or I have to go and advocate for people to give me some more money in order to be able to hire the staff. And we've been lucky in that we've had a lot of support from the university to do this. But we are a very small but mighty team trying to do what we can. And we're just hiring a third staff member. So that's very exciting. So we're going to have another full-time person on board soon.
Nice, nice. I have a so how I've heard about you, Keisha, was through the work that you've done with Terry over at Blue Quills. And you were talking earlier about, the how you said that you had been disconnected due to, your father growing up in foster care. And I was thinking about while you were talking, thinking about how, you were probably simultaneously going through this process of uncovering who you were while also doing this other work of uncovering. And so, working over at Blue Quills, for example, and all these other eight, you said, spaces that you've worked in. What are some of the things that you've been learning about yourself throughout each of these searches?
Been a lot of things I have learned about myself. The first, I think, that has been really important for me is I've always tried to do my work from the heart and from the spirit. That's not easy as an academic. Universities actually sort of seek to train us, sorry. Non-First Nations or non-Indigenous universities seek to train us in a way that really separates out the heart and the spirit from what we do. And archaeology is very much still thinks of itself as a science. And so even more so, it separates that out. And one thing I've really learned through this journey of working with these relatives and ancestors is that it has to be heart work and it has to be spirit work. And So my approach really resonates when I go into community, because I'm already coming from that place. I already know we have to start in ceremony, and I may not be the person to decide what that ceremony is. I shouldn't be. I don't have that knowledge, but I know that the communities that I go and work with will need to do those ceremonies, and we come to it from the heart. So that connection to heart and spirit is something that is really strengthened, I would say, through this process, reminding me why it's so important. And it has impacts on all of my work, because I can sort of stand in that in a different way than I could before. Also that I'm, this is really hard work. And what I've really learned is the need to connect with the ancestors when we do this. And for me in particular, connecting with my own ancestors, asking them to stand with me. So when there's a pipe ceremony and when there's prayer happening, or when I'm smudging before the day starts, I ask them to walk with me on this journey, because otherwise I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear it. I mean, 8 schools, how many graves? I don't even know, right? Or how many potential areas. I don't know how many relatives I've walked over, but many. And I spent a whole summer basically doing that. And that is very, very hard. The only way I can keep going is the sort of feeling supported by ancestors and living relatives as well. And then I've learned more about my own family. So a number of the places that I've worked, because of my many, many Alberta connections, I'm almost always working in places where I have relatives. And I don't always know who, but I'm learning sometimes. Like I working in Gruard with Kapawino First Nation, my great-grandfather was born not far from Gruard, and my great-great-grandfather lived in Gruard for most of his life. And I have relatives in the graveyard there. And so when I was doing the work in the cemetery, I may have been going over their graves, my relatives. And so that's also been sort of understanding the impacts that the residential school system had on my family. And also that resonance with my dad's experience. So he was not in residential school, but he was taken away and he was stolen. And he never had the chance to go home, and he still really can't. He still struggles. And so seeing the experience of people in community and talking about the harm that residential school did to them, I hear echoes of my dad. And that has been both triggering at times, but also important, because it's on my continued journey of understanding why, you know, he is the way he is, and why our family has been impacted the way it has, and that it's not his fault and it's not my fault. It's this colonial system which sought to destroy us. And I see that resonating, but I also see that resilience when I go into community. So it's that reminder that they didn't succeed. And my work coming home to community is partly an act of resistance to just being colonized, right? I don't want to. I want to reclaim that connection, that sense of identity, that sense of being Métis that my grandparents and great-grandparents had, because it's my right to do so, and I don't want to have to just be colonized, you know.
I remember, you know, having started the work as the Indian Residential School Coordinator at Blue Quills in June of last year, and connecting with you, Keisha. And, you know, and then we were able to meet and meet in person. And, you know, I echo those same words in regards to how this is very much spiritual work, because it's not your typical kind of work at the university, right? Like I was seconded essentially from one university to go back home and do this, and doing it with the intention of feeling that there was some role or responsibility that I have to my community as well. But I agree in that, you know, oftentimes, you know, I have people like Amber who check in with me often, who offer a lot of support and just seeing how I'm doing. But I think that ceremony has been definitely something that I have had to stay connected to throughout this whole process. And it was something that you've also experienced with us when we did the search. So it wasn't just a search process that was done, that we ensured that we had a 4-day fire going. We opened up the space to survivors and to community, intentionally brought in survivors who offered pipe ceremony in the mornings. And, you know, what I really appreciated from you, Keisha, was that you were always so willing to be in those spaces with us, you know, and you were not just willing, but you understood this work. And when you talk about it, you shared in that way, right? And you seen the importance of being, you know, when I mentioned, you're welcome to join us in the pipe ceremony, you're like, oh, absolutely. Like, I'm there, right? And your team was there, and you guys were able to also give information to our elders and our community members in those spaces. You know, I had the opportunity to even to operate the GPR just to see what it was like and what it looked like. And you were able to do that with people in the community and our survivors as well. And so there was such a gentleness and a kindness that you and your team brought to that space. And we also recognized how this is difficult work for you, you know, as there's like all these different roles, right, that everybody has during this process, whether that is survivors, whether that is support workers, IRS support workers, whether that's just our external communities, and then there's our search team. And it was really important that, you know, our search team was taken care of too. So, you know, they were brought in and they would be smudged and sung to at the end of the day. And just those practices of ensuring that we were all taking care of each other throughout this, that it wasn't just, you know, one group specifically, that we were all collectively holding space for one another. And so that leads into my next question, which is, you know, what has this experience been? And you shared a little bit about that. And I'm not sure if you want to share more, but what has this experience been for you and your team?
You know, working across different places, different cultural traditions, there's been really, each school has sort of had its own unique approach to the search. I will say we felt so cared for doing the work at Blue Quills in so many ways, but especially spiritually, really feeling wrapped in ceremony, and that it wasn't just, the burden wasn't on us to do it. It was elders and knowledge holders and pipe carriers who were connecting with spirit and asking for that additional help, and the songs and the drum. It was so, so amazing. And we've had, I mean, every place we've gone to has had ceremony in very different kinds of ways, but you're always working in different kinds of spaces, mm-hmm. right? So sometimes you're in the middle of an urban or a city space, much more open, much more kind of exposed. And that could be challenging because you have to deal with sometimes strangers sort of coming over and trying to ask what you're doing. And many times, like, we're so much community led that we don't want to be always the ones talking about things unless we're asked to by community. So we can be put in this weird position where it's like, we're not sure what we should be telling you to the stranger walking down the street when we're doing this work. So each environment has been a little bit different. And it's been also a learning process for us in terms of what our role is and what the community needs from us. I have really, really wanted to focus on that communications piece. So it's really great to sort of hear that reflected back, because there was a lot of information flying around after Tecumloops that wasn't actually connected to directly to the work that was done. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. Part of it's media, part of it's, you know, communication about the specifics of the work. So it's really important for me as someone who cares so deeply about this work to also be very careful around the use of the technology, mm-hmm. and not trying to overstate what we can and can't do. As much as I would love to be able to give survivors the answers they deserve, I know GPR is only one part of that process, and it can help, but it cannot provide certainty in the ways that nations and survivors want certainty. And so I've spent a lot of time, I think, trying to figure out how to communicate what we can and can't mm-hmm. do in a way that makes sense to people who aren't academics and who don't know the technology. And so trying to find metaphors or ways to connect to something people understand, to try to provide that back. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something I've gotten better at, because I've done so many community engagements and come talk to elders and survivors about what the technology can and can't do, and then provide the best advice I can based on what I know in order to approach, because again, each school is unique and it's never one nation, one school, right? So there's always different groups of survivors who need to be engaged and wanting to try to, again, provide the best I can provide at the moment, right? Which is, this is what I would recommend that you consider, and here's some things you might think about. But we always also really, the decision always lies with the community, right? Mm-hmm. We're not here to tell anyone what to do. We're here to sort of say, this is what GPR might be able to tell you. If you'd like us to use it, we can. And yeah, again, just trying to be really ethical in that approach and trying to be really clear in what's possible and what's not. Because for me, that's really also part of being heart-centered, is that I don't, you know, I'm not in this to try to tell some community that I can do something I can't, or to like these companies who come in to make money. Like that's not what I'm driven by. I want answers for these survivors and the justice and accountability and healing that can come from that.
Right. Can you, just for our listeners and me, tell me, I know it's massive, but in brief, what is GPR? What do you did? I know it's massive,
oh,
Keisha.
No, I can give you the like 3-minute spiel.
Okay, let's do it.
Now.
Let's do it.
So, basic principles of ground penetrating radar. It is an antenna which emits a wave. So it sends a wave down into the ground. If you've ever used a fish finder or like sonar, same principle. Sending a wave, but this time it's going into the ground as opposed to water. As the wave travels through the ground, it reflects back depending on the soil below or the properties of things below. So most, like if you have soil that's all the same, it'll kind of reflect the same. If you have a change in the soil, often the reflection will change. And if you have something different, like a rock, then the wave will reflect differently off the rock than it will around the surrounding soil. So basically what we do is we push this antenna across the ground and read all those reflections in the wave. And then we try to make sense of what those reflections are telling us. So when we're searching for potential unmarked graves, what we're looking for is the pit that is dug, because that changes the soil. It can change the moisture, it can change the mixture, it can change how compact it is. So we're trying to detect that grave shaft, basically. And the wave will sometimes show a different reflection in the place where there is potentially a grave shaft. Now, we can't tell if something is just a rectangular pit or if it's a grave. This, that being said, we do look for particular traits or characteristics. So shape, we can tell shape, we can tell depth, how deep something is usually, and then sort of its general orientation and size. So we're looking for pits that look like they could be graves, that are the right size, that go over enough of the lines, and that are, you know, reasonable depth. And that's when we say, okay, this is not a pipe, this is not a rock, this is not a tree root, this looks like it could potentially be a grave. This is an area that needs more investigation. So when we're doing it, we're basically creating a map of those different reflections and then trying to interpret them based on the best sort of scientific methods around this work, if that makes sense.
Totally. Thank you for that.
And so this past week, we were able to publicly share the findings from the first search that we did out at Blue Quills in August. And we were able to share that there was 19 areas, reflections of interest identified in the area, which was just under 1.3 acres. Mm-hmm. And it would have been on the southwest of the Blue Quills. And I think one of the things that, you know, I recognize through this process, and I always try to think of things and really reflect and process things as I'm moving through this, because again, this is a very new experience for me as well. And I'm very connected to Blue Quills, you know, having done my, I was in there when I was 2 weeks old, you know, as my mom took me into school with her. So I was in those schools with my mom. And then my dad is a survivor of Blue Quills as well. And so, you know, when these initially, the results were shared with me privately, it was a really difficult day for me. And it was actually on my birthday. And I was very emotional. And I had to, I felt like I was grieving, I was thinking like, what is this reminding me of? And it reminded me of the funeral day that I had of a late mentor of mine, Roxanne de Tousis. And I was like playing it out and I'm like, oh my God, I'm actually doing the same kind of things that I did that day, because she passed during COVID and her funeral was live streamed. So I was home. And some people could go in person to her funeral, but I stayed home. But my body felt exhausted, and my body, I felt like I immediately wanted to isolate. And I was, as I was, you know, experiencing this myself for the day, I was thinking about our survivors, and I was thinking about our community and thinking, okay, Terry, what would you need right now? Like, what are the things that would maybe potentially help you? Like, thinking in the sense of, like, when we share these publicly in a couple weeks, what does our community need? And recognizing some of the things, you know, knowing that we were going to do a gathering, we were going to have a four-day fire again, we were going to have supports in place, give people the opportunity to share stories in circle, and, of course, you know, doing many different things, healing through art, healing through song, but also recognizing the process of mourning, because I think that many of our people have known, right? Like, we've known this, and then it's this almost this validation to others or other non-Indigenous people saying, see, this is what we've known, and people actually believing us or believing our survivors of the stories that they've been sharing for so long. And then also, like, from that process, really trying to I don't even know, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay.
And I think that what I was gonna say is that this is a time now where I feel like it's, you know, our communities or our people can mourn. And maybe we haven't had the time. And we talk about this in our training around historical trauma. And how sometimes we don't know why we're angry, or we don't know why we're sad. You know, when there's been all these voids and these disruptions within our communities, disruptions of love because of IRS. And I have seen and witnessed this process and this journey as an opportunity for healing, as an opportunity for our people to mourn and not have that disruption of just knowing that, you know, there was so many stories shared where it's like, you know, we seen our friend, you know, our this girl, and then one day she's gone, you know, and then this is creating that opportunity that our children are being found and our children are coming home. And so creating opportunities for through this process for healing, creating opportunities for people to collectively come together and share in space as we would in a wake or in a funeral, right? Where we have those times to come together and share. And oh my God, I just have real snotty nose. Have I ever cried on a podcast? I'm like, I don't want to sound like I'm snotty nosed on my podcast, on our podcast. So Amber's just grabbing me some Kleenex. But you know, I think that it was definitely, and I think about our support workers, and you know, as somebody who is a supervisor, director in an institution, you know, part of my role is and focus has always been taking care of my team. And when I think about IRS support workers, there's such a huge need for them to also be taken care of through this process, and how they are not carrying a lot of this. Because again, like I said, like that day where I had to sit for days with this information alone. And then, you know, additionally, another week or so until we could publicly release. And then it's odd because when we were able to share that day, last Wednesday, it was like, oh, you know, there was just like this relief that I could also just talk about it publicly with people, and I could share and sit in those spaces. And so, you know, I was saying in an interview that this, as difficult as this work is, it's such an amazing opportunity for healing. And I've been able to witness that in my role at Blue Quills over the last 10 months. You know, just the space that we create for that. And that's so important to approach this work in a trauma-informed way, ensuring that we are doing this gently, ensuring that we are supporting one another, and that we are kind to one another. And one of the things that, you know, I've experienced is that, you know, when we are working with people who have experienced a long trauma story, is that when they start sharing, and we have a lot of survivors who are sharing for the first time ever in their lives, or coming on site for the first time, is that first response sometimes is anger, right? Mm-hmm. And it gets drawn towards one person, but it's not them that they're angry with, right? It's them expressing themselves and try to move through some of that grief and that trauma that they've experienced. And so I've had to ensure that I don't personalize that I haven't, and you probably experienced this too, Keisha, in your work, mm-hmm. is that, you know, that the anger comes at you, and recognizing that that's not our stuff, right? That's not our stuff. And that if we continue just to hold that space, we can allow people to move through some of that.
Yes, and while my team, we're not the support workers, we have a lot shared with us because we're there. And it can be, you know, a lot of anger, it can be a lot of grief, it can be, you know, all sort of range of things, and trying to make sure that we have the supports that we need, not just from the spiritual side, which is of course important, but also the mental health supports, because it can be a lot. And many of my team are Indigenous as well, and so live with that intergenerational trauma in different kinds of ways. And, you know, making sure that we're recognizing and caring for each other. And also, like I said, recognizing that when you just need to hold that space, but not take on the burden of those emotions, mm-hmm. Recognizing that they need to be worked through, you know, that can be hard in the moment, because we also get triggered into our own traumas, mm-hmm. at times. But I think it's something that I certainly have been learning to do more, because I have to hope that this is going to be healing, because otherwise I couldn't do it, because it is also bringing up so much for so many that sometimes you really just see that sort of trauma coming back to the surface. But I have to believe that it's in a way that can really move that through, and mourning not just for those who are lost, but also for what could have been. I think a lot about that. Mm-hmm. And I think about that in my own family. Like, what would have happened had my dad been able to grow up with his family, and what a different kind of life we would have led, and a different kind of, I may not have lost my language, you know, I may not have had that same sense of disconnection that I think originally drew me to archaeology in the first place, which was, I didn't know who I was and I wanted to know. And so I think that really centering that healing and centering that space for those difficult emotions to move through, I think will take us down that path toward healing. Because if you hold on to those, and so many have not only held on to them, but held them deep inside, it can make it a lot harder to heal. Right? Mm-hmm. We need to be able to express that. And this is, for better or for worse, bringing so much of that to the surface. So not just finding these beloved children, but also allowing the space for those survivors who are also children who were lost to find their way, right? To find their way back.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for bringing the science, to this as well. Our people, we know our people are scientists. We have scientists all in our nations. And so thank you for bringing science back to this as well. Because like Terry was saying, you know, like we've heard these stories, you know, in our families forever, you know, since, you know, folks like Terry and I, how old are we? Do you want to say on the podcast? I'm 25.
29. Yeah. 29 and holding.
29 and holding. But, you know, as second generation, you know, I think that, again, like we've heard these stories. And so how this has, as an academic and as someone who teaches courses, you know, about Indian residential schools and our histories, there's data that we can hang on to. And I can present data along with this. And not that our stories aren't enough, because they are. They are enough. And they always have been enough. But there, we know that there has been these, you know, narratives around, you know, but really though, you know, those questions around, mm-hmm. did that really happen? And so now that there's data that coincides or aligns with our stories, we can't ignore this, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that was true when, you know, the 215, when those 215 mm-hmm. children or unmarked graves, when that data was released, I think that it really shook the country and well, beyond. And mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, we knew this, you know, and so now there's data to back it up. And so thank you for being part of that process, you know, and hearing you say that this work has also been incredibly difficult for you as well. Thank you for doing that hard work that has provided, you know, our nations with the data to say, here's the data that shows, you know, our stories they're real. So mm-hmm. I just want to say thank you for that, for going into archaeology and and for being, what did you say, a super nerd? Is that what you said?
Well, I am that. Especially when it comes to technology, I get super nerdy about it. I will say.
Thank
We're
you
just
for
about
being...
to upgrade a whole bunch of our machines to get like the next gen of stuff. And I'm gonna perhaps inappropriately excited about it, because it's gonna make even better data. But I also just want to say, like, I completely agree. I wish you didn't need the science for people to really listen, right? Survivors know the truth. Our communities know the truth. I'm not in the job of trying to prove things. I have, however, and this comes back to the point that you were talking about, Terry, there is power in, like, here. Right there, here is something that we're seeing, and the specific locations, because often survivors have knowledge of an area, but then I can say, well, you know, here, and that can be really important. And there is power in the data, and not just for the the non-Indigenous Canadians who sometimes need the science in order to believe what we know to be true, but also for survivors and families to be able to say, here's areas we can investigate, here's areas that have additional evidence that we can then or do ceremony or mark or do further investigations on. And I think there's a lot of power that has brought as well, even though it is hard. I find it actually the hardest part of the work is bringing results back to community. I find it really, really difficult. Right? It's one thing to know that it's there, but then to be able to come back and say, well, this is what we found. Because it's always a lot, but never enough. Because I can't say I found your children. I can say I found a spot where there could potentially be children. Right? So it's that space is, I find, really, really difficult. I wish I could provide better answers, and I'm doing the best I can, but the science is not yet caught up with Indigenous knowledge in so many ways, but in this way as well.
And so one of the I'll ask this last question to you, Keisha, in the way that you approach the work that you're doing with in regards to data sovereignty and community-led in regards to the unmarked graves. Do you want to talk about kind of your approach to that?
I would love to, because this is really, really important in all of the work that I do, both as an academic who works in an institution who has, the institution I work for and many, many, many institutions have extracted and stolen and incarcerated knowledge. I think about it more and more as a form of incarceration. And, still tends to say, oh, well, anything that our professors do belongs to us as a university. Very strongly argue against that, and also have gotten the university to say, no, this is not appropriate for the university to have. So especially around the work around unmarked graves, I completely, well, one, I center in data sovereignty, but also it has to be community-led and community-driven. This is not research. I don't think of this as research. I think of this as a form of service. I try to advance the research side of it in terms of better methods and better knowledge of the science, but the work itself is not research. And I really recognize how sensitive this information is and how important it is that community has full control over who has access to it, who has possession of it, OCAP principles. So early on in this process, there was some conversation around whether or not the provincial government would require archaeological permits for this type of work. And there are some provinces who are requiring that for kind of regulatory reasons. But I actually strongly advocated against that because I did not want community or nation to be forced to provide a report to the government around the location. If they choose to share, fine. I did not want it to be a requirement. That's really, really important to me. And the province listened, and there are no requirement to report back if it's back to the government in this way. And that's so, so essential to the work that I do. And it's really been pushing the conversation in the other aspects of the research that I do. So the archaeology that I do when I go out and do excavations, because Indigenous data sovereignty is not recognized or affirmed by existing heritage law. We actually don't have our rights recognized to the belongings and ancestors in this place. They belong to the provincial crown, right? And so this is why our belongings and ancestors are incarcerated in museums, because we don't have data sovereignty over them. So this is really inspiring me to continue. I've advocated for this for a long time, but to actually make real steps toward changing that, because we have the right to decide what happens to our ancestors and our belongings and our data around the past. And so if nothing else, by the end of my career, if I could see real change in the law and like the policy and the approach to archaeology in this country, where Indigenous data sovereignty and rights to our own cultural heritage were affirmed, then that would be enough. That would be enough for me, because I care so much about that. I think it's just so essential to building a better future for us, mm-hmm. is to be able to reclaim those ancestors and belongings from the past.
Yeah, and I could just, you know, attest to that in the sense that having been, you know, doing Indigenous research for many years and working in a public institution as well prior to being at Blue Quills, you know, I'm always really careful about mm-hmm. the research done with Indigenous people, specifically our elders and our knowledge keepers, and especially around this project. And so, you know, we've definitely we're mindful of that process, and you know, Keisha, you never wanted necessarily, again, like you came in on it as just offering a service to help us mm-hmm. In mm-hmm. this work, and all the research part that we've done thus far has been specifically within Blue Quills and our IRS team, and that has stayed within within Blue Quills specifically, and within our community where it should be, right? And so I appreciate that, I really do, because I think that sometimes we've had experiences with other researchers or other organizations who may not see it that way. And so I thank you for that. And I thank you for coming into this work in such a good way and in a meaningful way. And because of that, we were able to really develop this great relationship and continue on with this work. And one of the things, so we're wrapping up phase one at Blue Quills, and we are going to be moving into other phases as well, because we know that this work, and this is the thing, is that, you know, this work is going to be, it's going to take a long time. You know, when I was sharing with elders at the gathering this past week, and I'm like, this is just the beginning. But it's also a beginning of those opportunities for healing, right? For people to come together and to gather and to share as they need. And we get to be part of that and witness that and share in that space. And so we know that we have many years to still go. And I know that you're busy as ever, Keisha. I can't, you just need a whole team.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is true. This is a long journey. And, you know, for me, I'm very committed to walking that journey wherever I can be useful, right? Wherever I can be helped. And I feel, coming back to what I've learned in this process, I've learned that the ancestors have asked me to do this. And the children have asked me to do this. And I've gotten multiple messages when I've been in places from the children themselves. They're just really grateful that we're doing this. And so I will keep doing it as long as the ancestors and the children need me to.
Mm-hmm. Just taking a deep breath. Mm-hmm. As we wrap up, Keisha, is there any closing comments that you have for us and our listeners?
I'm really grateful for the opportunity to talk about this, and also have been really grateful for the opportunity to work with Blue Quills and the amazing team there. Like I said, it's been such a uplifting and supportive experience for me and my whole team. And the centering of the healing and the support, I think, is so important. This is so much more than just GPR to try to find unmarked graves. It's really about, for me, it's about the seven generations to come. It's about building a different future. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that I think about my daughter and her children and her children's children growing up in a very different world than I did and my dad did. And this is part of that work, because we have to be able to heal in order to continue to build those vibrant and amazing communities that we have and that we've inherited. So, you know, ultimately, I always think about this as that seven generations to come. Mm-hmm. And it keeps me going, thinking about that, and yeah, so that's what I'd like to end with, I think.
Nice. Thank you, Keisha, and thank you for joining us on Two Crees in a Pod.
Thanks for having me.
Two Crees in a Pod. 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 Natani Means.
Yo.
Let's go.
They pushed us to this point, frustrations of a common man. Manifested destiny, preach and pledge the promised land. I'm stuck between taking my journey, live with no honor. Like what's the use if my kids can't taste clean water? A child born into a world, revolution's not a choice. Fighting to be heard so we make them hear our voice. Remember ancestors' anguish lightning in our veins. Hear it in the language when they are kitchen for the rain. I am product of people that persevere persecution. Paint me so creator sees me if I go out shooting. Experience our pain when our women disappear daily. Anxious to be angry, pacifists might hate me. Trolls on the internet constantly trying to bait me. We move in silence, cover of the night, learning from the wolves in the forest, tracking enemies in the woods. Reincarnations of warriors riding for salvation, or are we false prophets when we submit to temptation? Colonization is a hell of a drug. We all seem to go crazy when we fall in love. I said colonization is a hell of a drug. We all seem to go crazy when we fall in love. I said
Two Crees in a Pod.
So welcome to Two Crees in a Pod. We are still in season 5, and this is episode 5. And today we are joined by TJ Gadwa and Emery Assiniboine. So thank you both for agreeing to be on a podcast with us. I know that me and Amber have been talking for a while, and we really wanted the two of you to share your stories with us. And so thank you. So we'll get started by giving you the opportunity just to introduce yourselves in whichever way that you feel comfortable with our listeners. Whoever wants to start first.
Well, I'll go first. Hello, everybody. My name is Emery Assiniboine. I'm from the Long Plain First Nation out of Manitoba, as well as the Niigani Cree Nation here in Southwest Saskatchewan. Yeah, that's me.
Hey, it's TJ Gadwa. I am from the Kahivan Cree Nation and Carry the Kettle, Nakota Nation. That's me.
Nice. Thank you. All right. Well, we've got lots of questions. Are you ready?
I think so. As ready as we can be.
Awesome. As Terry mentioned, we were really looking forward to having both of you on Two Crees in a Pod. And one of the reasons why, we were so interested in having you both is watching both of you. Like, I've seen you out in the powwow world together. You know, and I've been able to witness the two of you out there in the powwow world with your babies and your family. And I've been able to see the way that the two of you work together, you know, with two little ones. You have two little ones. And I've been able to watch the two of you grow that way and grow your family. And so my first question is, tell me your love story. Tell me the story of, or even snippets of your story of like when you knew that, you know, TJ, when did you know Emery was your person? Emery, when did you know TJ was your person? I want to hear about your love.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Do you want me to go first?
Go for it.
Okay. Here's my version of our love. We kind of were like, I think they might ask this, so we kind of covered it a little bit before, prior to having this conversation with you guys. But we had talked about it, like, when did we first notice each other? Because we had not mutual friends, just friends in passing. I had a best friend who's TJ's cousin when we were teenagers, and We kind of came to a conclusion. We met as teenagers, like we weren't introduced, but we were like, oh yeah, this is so and so, and it's like, oh hey, and on to our way. Like, we didn't even bat an eye that we would be raising kids together as teenagers. But that's, I think, when we first met each other. And then again, I saw TJ, I think I might have been about, like, I don't even know, 20? But I had saw TJ specifically dancing in a special one time. And so I saw her dancing, and I felt like I was just, it was supper break, and I was, like, you know, eating my fries and whatever, and I'm, like, my energy was just called to her. Like, I didn't feel like, you know, when you see, like, a hot, sexy guy and you're like, oh, damn, like, it wasn't that kind of, like, attraction. It was, like, my spirit or my energy was, like, beep, beep, going off. And I'm like, okay, that's weird. And I'm like, hmm. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And I still never went and tried to, like, find her or get introduced or introduce myself. But that's when I had first noticed her later on as adults, and still not even making the connection that this is the person I met when I was a teenager. And so, yeah, that was me. That's when I first noticed TJ. And from then on, and then after that, I never, like, saw her again, I guess. I don't know. And it wasn't until maybe a year or two after that, that we finally were introduced, and the rest is history, which is completely different. Like, we were introduced by one of, like, I take this, she's our age, hey? She's our age. Yeah. I take her as a niece, and this is, like, one of TJ's adopted cousins, so we're, like, my niece and her TJ's cousin, and kind of introduced us. And I'm like, why are you trying to hang out with me? Like, why? Like, it was really out of the norm for this niece of mine to want to hang out with me, because I normally didn't hang out with her. And I'm like, okay. And she'd, like, be like, yeah, come hang out with us. And TJ would be, like, doing the, you know, walking by, really, like, trying to get me to notice her. And yeah, it didn't, like, I wasn't like, oh, hey, yeah, let's talk. It was like, hey, what do you want? Like, do you need something from me? Or, like, what do you want?
It's pretty straightforward like that. That was rough. That first moment was rough.
Why?
Why? What do you mean?
I always thought I had game, but I didn't have not when it came to Emery.
It's not ignored. Because, like, yeah. She just humbled you.
She just humbled you, TJ.
That moment in time, like, emotionally and mentally, I was in this space where I was like, I don't want to be in a relationship. Like, I was enjoying being single. I didn't want to be in a relationship at that point in time.
Yeah.
You're like, I knew.
Yeah.
I know.
I got that vibe. Consistent is key. Just kidding. I knew, it gets really weird. I knew when she was in her previous relationship. I seen her at, I think it was here in Saskatoon at their powwow. And she was helping them get ready and whatnot. And my nephew's like, Auntie, that's so-and-so and Emery. I'm like, oh, well, she's too beautiful to be with him. Why is she with him? I said, nephew, that's going to be my wife one day. Watch. Oh. I was like, I was 19. Oh, I was 19 at the time, and that's when I seen her with her previous partner. And fast forward to this time.
Amber's crying right now.
I'm crying.
Fast forward to this time where we met a Paul band. Yeah, she was, like, not interested at all. But, I mean, why not give it a try? So, we met up at Frog Lake, and I asked for her number. And I texted her right away because I was like, man, she's probably just playing. She's probably playing. Probably gave me a fake number. I'm gonna check it out. I'm gonna text it. I was like, is this really you? And she was like, yeah, what do you want? I'm like, holy crap. Hi.
What do you want?
Oh, Emery.
Oh, Emery. Oh, you're kind of rough, eh?
Brutal. She was very brutal. Yes. I really like our story of how we met, and I asked her to be my girlfriend 3 times, and she said no all 3 times. But she still stuck around and agreed to be my life partner.
We later talked about it. We later talked about it, and it was that, like, I don't want to be tied down. Like, that's where it came from, because I still, like, was like, but I still want to hang out with you. Like, let's see where this goes.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't want to be my girlfriend. Yeah, that's all I, from my perspective, everything I, what she said was on point.
And her mom had asked too in recent years about, you know, why, how did you know it was TJ? How did you, what kept you staying to go back, you know, seeing her, if you didn't want to be her girlfriend and you didn't want this and that? And I said it was her kindness. Like, she was the first person to be kind to me and genuinely want to make sure that I was okay. Right? And it was weird. Like, it was weird for her to be like, okay, well, do you have gas money home? Even something simple like that. I'm like, yeah, but, like, why? Are you going to give me gas money if I don't? Like, it was just out of the norm for me and in our relationship. But when I knew... It was maybe like we started dating prior in springtime, or no, sorry, fall time. And by springtime, I already kind of knew, I think it was after my birthday in January, that I knew we might be serious and that, you know, the talk had to come, right? This big talk with, you know, summer's coming up. Are we going to be traveling together or not? And so... The talk came, and it was the first time that I was, you know, really vulnerable in saying, you know, if we decide to be together, if we want to continue to, you know, move forward together as a couple, I want you to know, and I need to know for my own, you know, my own self, that I'm not stuck with you. Like, I don't want to go into this relationship, where it's did and done and you're here forever if I decide to say yes. And I said, I want you to know that the door is always open to leave, and that, like, I need to know that as well, right? And that was kind of the basis of our relationship, in, you know, creating our relationship with the doors always open, and the goal is to make sure that we keep it a place where we want to be, right? Together. And so it was really the first time that I ever approached a relationship that way. And I didn't know how TJ was going to, like, respond to it. I don't know. I feel like I texted her that, and I was like, send. And you know how you kind of throw your phone and you're like, oh, see if she replies. If not, then we're done. You know? And so she was really, to me, it seemed like she was very open to continuing on and agreeing. In that, you know, if there were other people that we wanted to pursue, we would let each other know.
That was the healthiest thing I've ever heard. Fuck yeah. All right, let's do this.
Yeah. I'm in. You got me. And I love that, because I think that, like, how you were just describing that, Emery, around that, keeping the relationship a place you want to be, and that it's, you know, oftentimes, you know, especially as a younger person, and even in my older years too, like, you know, getting into relationships and being like, you know, right away you shock up, you know, you're just right in it, you know, like, and it's, that's it, you know, and, yeah. And rather than having that as the focus, like you said, like, did and done, you're locked in, you know, that you approach this relationship, both of you approach this relationship as making it a place that you want to be. And that if one of you or both of you decided that it's not a place you wanted to be, that you could exit. And that that was something you agreed upon. And like you said, TJ, like, that's really healthy to approach relationships that way. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. You got a question?
I just have a lot of thoughts. I do. And I appreciate both of you for sharing. And, you know, I think about, you know, Emery, when you talked about when you first seen TJ dancing. And it was, this, it was your spirit calling. I believe that. And that there was this spiritual connection. Mm-hmm. And I can relate to that in many ways. And that is such a beautiful thing to experience within that relationship. And the other piece too is like, when we get into spaces and we are loving of ourselves and we love ourselves, we go into relationships with really healthy boundaries and expectations. And oftentimes, and like, again, when I was young, I I got into relationships very quickly and, you know, shacked up and did it because I was searching. I whether I had low self-esteem or I was looking for love, right? In an unhealthy way. And so it was like just taking any kind of love that would come to me, regardless if it was unhealthy love. And I think that, you know, as I learned and I grown, it's different. And so to be able to recognize that and to create that opportunity, I hope our young people learn from that,
yes.
You know, that it's okay, like, to take the time, and it's okay to create the opportunities to experience one another, another in different ways and in new situations and relationships. And so I love that. One of the things Amber and I had a question in regards to is because you both have two beautiful babies, and I've met both of them in different spaces, in ceremony. And the question is when did you decide on children, the both of you, and the process of having children?
I can just give a little bit about like me personally. I give credit to my grandmothers. They both took part in having a little bit of time raising me, and they always had mentioned that, you know, live a life as if your children are always watching, you know, from a younger, probably about 12. And so I always kind of had that at the back of my mind. And so even in relationships and searching for somebody who I seen or wanted to be long term, it was always, you know, how is this person going to be with children? And so, you know, that was another thing too. We had talked about maybe 5 years into our relationship, maybe four. We had kind of agreed already that we wanted to have children one day, someday. And we didn't know what that process was going to look like because we are same gendered and we didn't know where to even begin or where to start. And so, yeah, we had kind of put the prayer out too that we would find someone or something to help us in becoming parents. And I this little piece I want to just give mention to Colby and Andrea, like their journey too has been so beautiful to watch in becoming parents and what they've practiced. And we take a lot of their workshops and sit in and attend, and it's been the basis of becoming parents, where we had to do that really hard piece before even conceiving, on looking at our own childhoods and what we want to bring, what we want to stop or what we want to shift. And that was really the tough part, like the growing pains part, was looking at ourselves and, you know, being 100% real with it. And just a little example of that is the way we handled our disagreements. Like, it wasn't always hunky-dory with us in our relationship either, but it, like, there were times when it was 4 days of silence because we were the quiet, you know, that was our go-to. We were both quiet and mad, and not talking about why we were mad or what even happened on why we became mad. And so now, I mean, it's maybe half an hour, maybe a couple minutes, but
it's not that long. It's not 4 days no more.
But it took that that realness to sit our, you know, sit down at the table and talk about what we're doing or what we're feeling. And I told, like I had mentioned too to TJ prior to having kids, is that, you know, if when we have kids, we can't be sitting here for weeks mad at each other because they're going to feel our vibes. We're going to, Colby had mentioned that, you know, parents usually create the moods of the homes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's kind of when we knew we wanted children. Still wondering how the process was going to go, though. At this point, we knew I wanted to carry the babies. I wanted to carry.
I wanted you to carry the babies.
No problem.
Yeah, then that's when the research and readings, articles all came in and process, trying to figure out, you know, the difference between like the artificial insemination and then the you know, like doing it yourself and then going to the doctor to do it,
mm-hmm.
and having to figure it out that way was the trialing part.
Hmm.
It's a long process though.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And when you say long process, like, how, like, was that your decision making or was that the actual process or the, well, it's all the process, but the time that you decided to have children and then to conceive, was that the long process?
I think, well, they were all kind of equally long, but I think finding a donor was kind of the most. And then learning about, you know, like when, like ovulation times and all that, you have to like be spot on point. Like that was kind of the longest process. And so about, let's see, it's 2016 is when we kind of started the process of asking, I want to say asking people, we asked a few of TJ's friends who agreed but weren't healthy in the moment, struggled with their own stuff at the time, and that's when we kind of thought maybe we need to go a different route, maybe we need to find something else. And we found this website, and like it's not like, I don't know if it's something that I can share on here, but like it was a website that kind of you had to pay for, which is one thing that I wanted it to be kind of, I don't know what the word would be, but more legit maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So we paid into it and we kind of just searched around for a bit. So we didn't start asking people right away. And we were looking for like Indigenous donors or First Nations donors. And there was nothing on this website. And we kind of did more research trying to find Indigenous or First Nations donors throughout Canada, and we couldn't find much. So we did find our donor through this website, and we had met only two, and they were there. We always give thanks to them. They were really normal people, and they were really willing to sit with us and hear what we wanted, and what we had to also hear what they wanted as well. I don't know if that answers the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. So one of the things that you mentioned before we were starting the recording is that you both have been asked a lot of questions from others, from other folks as well. And so maybe we can move in that direction. If there's questions that, you know, people have reached out to both of you and asked that you want to answer on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. So what are the common, you know, when you scroll down a website and it says frequently asked questions, what are TJ and Emery's frequently asked questions?
the most generic one was, well, how'd you guys do it?
And we're like, well, when a man and a woman.
Well, see ya, Kayas.
And I'll be a little bit vulnerable with you here. When we were telling our moms, you know, but of course our moms were super happy, super, oh my God, yay, we're going to be, you know, kukums and kushis. And but later on, my mom was like, well, I was wondering too, like, how did you guys have a baby? How did, you know, what, like, this was later, this yeah. prior, baby was already born. And, you know, so she was like, I thought you might have had to go and, like cheat on TJ. Like, no, mom, God. That's what happened. So I was saying to TJ, like, if that's what our own moms are thinking, you know, I don't put it past anybody to wonder as well, right? Like, what happened? Oh, there's a baby here now. So a lot of the questions were, you know, where can we go? Like, I'm whatever label they identify as, and they say, like, I want to have a family one day, or, you know, it's something I wanted to bring up with my own parents, is that it's not that I'm not going to have children. There are different ways to have children too.
Yeah.
I also think too, and I just want to say this out loud, because I think it also applies. I watched a documentary recently, and I actually showed it to one of my classes, and I teach a social work with families class at the university, and we talk about, you know, very diverse families. And, you know, as the two of you know, there's so many different families that social workers are working with today. It's not the mom, dad, two kids, and the dog. It's, you know, two-spirit couples. It's single parents. It's, you know, fathers who are parenting alone or independently, women who are parenting alone independently. We've got and a lot of blended families. And so one of the things that also I think that my mind went to was around even people who want a parent, but they don't want to be in a relationship. They just want to have, they want a parent. And so they don't want to have to be connected to the other person. They want to have a baby. They want to raise that baby independently. And they don't want to be in this quote unquote nuclear family. And we have so much of that, right? So we have a lot of, you know, people, both men, women, and two-spirit queer folks who are doing exactly this and parenting without another person. And they do that by choice, which I think is also really important too. So like sharing your journey may also apply and help other folks who want to parent, but want to do it independently.
Yeah, totally. And that's part of that just brought up so each like donor would have what they wanted. So some of them were just straight being donors and no contact, no nothing, no pictures, no nothing. Or they were like, hey, I want to co-parent with somebody, like you can, we'll work it out. However, they had these kind of bios on there. So yeah. It was kind of neat in that aspect. And
that was the coolest thing about this website is you literally, it was like a, find a donor like Facebook. Facebook for donors only. It was really cool, and it was really neat, and being able to meet with them, set up times and whatnot. It was really nice.
It was really cool to meet them and kind of get the energy and to feel them and who they are. And and we hadn't, throughout our journey, we had two people who kind of were our go-to people to talk about what we were going through. We hadn't shared much, even with our own families, that we were trying to conceive. and it got really hard. It got to the point where, you know, we were questioning if we should be together, and maybe this is a reason why it's not working or why we aren't conceiving. After we did find a donor, it took a while. It took about a good over a year to finally conceive our firstborn. And we did a lot. Like, it broke us to our core to just sit with ourselves and to really see if this is what we wanted or if this is where we should be. And then even to question, you know, us as a couple and our relationship. And it tore me, like, in being vulnerable with you guys, it tore me to love somebody like TJ and be in love, and but also really, really want to have children. And so it was this, you know, is it that I, you know, leave for a few years and conceive children, or stay with TJ and be in love and not have children? So that's where I felt in those moments of,
yeah, the self questions really came in. And same with me, it was a question of, okay, I love this woman and I love her enough that if it's not gonna work out and we're not gonna be successful with the conceiving, just let her go and find that partner and let her have babies. You know, if that's the way it needs to be, then that's what how it would have to play out for us. And these questions were really freaking hard, holy man. And I think once we were really discussing it and talking about it, okay, well, if it's not working, then maybe we do, you know, maybe this is our path where we need to separate, where we go our own ways. And as we were talking about it, we had this lamp behind us, and it wasn't plugged into the wall, it wasn't turned on, like, couldn't be, right? And all of a sudden, we just hear, poof, there's like a little lightning bolt right through the light bulb. It didn't crack it or anything, it just went right through. And it's like, okay, well, we hear you, but it's not working out for us.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, maybe let's try again. Let's see. Let's keep going.
And in that moment, we were literally at the table, and this pop happens, and it went dead silent. And we're like, where did that come from? And so the person we were talking with, there was three of us, me, TJ, and this person, and they're like, holy smokes, like, what is this? And it was maybe a few months after that we had been in ceremony, and our baby announced herself prior to coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she came and told us in ceremony. And we weren't telling our families about this, just a couple of people. And when she came and announced herself, everyone was like, oh my god, who's pregnant, who's having a baby? And then they looked at us and said, you guys? No. It's not us. We're not doing that. And then I think that was, I think the month after we found out that it worked. We were successful.
And I just gotta, like, I gotta put you on the spot here. When we had found out about our firstborn, we're at a powwow, surprisingly. And we were at a powwow, and we were getting gas before the powwow, and I'm like, yeah, like, I'm just gonna do a check. So I checked with did a pregnancy test at the gas station before a powwow, and I checked and I came out. And of course, I'm like trying to be all stoic and not telling and not trying to be normal. And TJ was going to get in from after doing the gas. And so she gets in and I'm like, TJ. And I had showed her the pregnancy test, and she kind of just deer in the headlights, looks at me and shuts the door. And I'm like, okay. And she busies herself, right? So she starts washing the windows, and I'm like, maybe she didn't see me. And then we were just like we had a half an hour drive to the pow, and it was just dead silent, and we were just like smiling like all the way. So you see two people heading to the pow smiling and not talking, and so that was our,
it was the greatest.
Oh jeez. Oh man, I think I've cried more in this episode than I have.
Amber's crying through this whole thing. And I think that
Oh, I can't even talk.
And I think, like, as advice for, like, others or same-gendered people, any other label-identifying people out there, like, it is so important to have those kinds of supports. Like, even if it didn't work with us, at least we had two solid people who were going to hold the space for us should anything happen. Yeah. And, you know, I always, like, I pray for them all the time. They were really, I don't even know, they held us up when we could barely hold ourselves together.
They carried hope for you guys,
mm-hmm.
for both they of you. Did. They held that space for hope. And that's important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we have those relationships and those friends and those families around you that you know, when we are in those spaces of darkness, that they hold that space of light for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think about, you know, I think about love. And I think about, you know, TJ, when you made the comment about, you know, even if you weren't successful in conceiving, that you loved her enough to let her go. Oh.
and how selfless that is. And I think that that's what love is. It's selfless. And that's not even just that doesn't even just apply to, like, our partnerships with our like our intimate partners, but just with our kids, the people that we love. And it just,
holy, shut us up. You shut us up.
And you guys asked us if we were ready.
What's that?
And you guys asked us if we were ready.
And so we weren't ready. I wasn't ready.
Apparently not.
Wasn't ready. And so, you know, one of the things that and as we're kind of coming to an end of our discussion, and I don't want this discussion to end, but I also recognize we could sit here all night. You know, if you were to speak directly to the younger yous, you know, the younger Emery, the younger TJ, you know, before this love story began and you were discovering, you know, and unpacking or unlearning or thinking about, like, you know, what direction your life would go in, and here you are now, like, what are those messages that you would send to young people, like when you were young? You know, and that they're trying to understand who they love, what they want, if they want children, if they don't want children. Like, what are some of the things that you would like to share with your younger selves that might be seen in other young selves?
It was something that Emery shared earlier, is, you know, live your life the way you want, or how you want, as if your children are here already, you know. I think that's a very important one to, you know, to sit with and to recognize, because your children are always watching. They're there, and it's a beautiful thing when you're able to, just be with that.
Yeah. And I think for me, it would be that big piece on connecting with ourselves. You know, I talked about being, when I had met TJ, I was in that space of not even wanting to be in a relationship, because I had this really great relationship with myself. And prior to that, I was single for a year before meeting TJ. And, you know, so I was 20, 21, but realizing then that, you know, like, it got to the point in being in relationships where it wasn't my initial questions about starting things like university, like programs, trainings, it wasn't, do I want this? It's, what's my partner going to do? How are they, you know, it was straight directly to the other person. And that was a light bulb moment for me where it's like, I needed it to be about me. And so I think for our younger people, I think that piece is really big with getting to know yourself. I don't know how young we start dating nowadays, but, you know, I started when I was 18. So 18, 19, 20, 3 years of consistently being with somebody and not ever being with just myself. Hmm. Yep. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
We get to watch you. The listeners don't get to watch, but Amber and I get to watch the way that you both look at each other. And as we wrap up, I just want to give both of you an opportunity to share with our listeners any closing comments that you have for the folks out there listening.
I think for the folks out there listening, you know, Amber had mentioned that, you know, we do as First Nations, Nehiyaw, Dakota, all the nations, we come with trauma, but we also, you know, sometimes don't focus on that love piece, that the good stuff that comes with being First Nations. Mm. And I think for any young families in general, I think that important piece of reconnecting with ourselves and doing our own work is going to be the impacts, generational impacts for those to follow us, those to come after us. And just another little bit is that we had just a few days ago, we were talking about, you know, this is the first generation with our two girls that they're able to grow up emotionally free. You know, they know they don't control, you know, their parents' emotions. And it's so beautiful. And I think that, like, I always give thanks to my mom and my grandmothers and my dad and my grandfathers who endured what they did for us to be here.
How am I supposed to follow that? No, seriously. That's beautiful. Mm. And I've got nothing. It's just
nothing. Just ditto? Same. Ditto. Right? Anista, Mina.
I hear what she said.
And thank you both. Thank you for your vulnerability. Thank you for mm-hmm. your willingness to share. Thank you for sharing your love with us. And like mm-hmm. Terry said, our listeners, you know, they'll hear the audio, but they didn't get to see, you know, the two of you. And I remember the last time we felt like this, we were watching Patrick and Marissa Mitswing on screen, and the way that they looked at each other and the way that they held each other up. Oh my God, I left there just wanting a man. Oh, I was like, now I want another one. Someone who's going to ask me, do you got gas money? That's how you'll know. Hey, listeners, that's how you know if they're the one. If they ask you at the powwow, you got gas money to get home? If they don't ask you, get rid of them.
Oh my God, that's love indicator.
Yeah, that's an indicator of love. I'm going to write that down. If they ask you if you got gas money to get home from the powwow. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you both for joining us on Two Crees in a Pod. And we love you.
Yes.
Thank you for having us.